Coming up this hour on the Kojo Namdi Show, at every home game, the Washington Wizards announcer describes the team as representing the most powerful city in the world. But compared with other major capitals, Washington, in the eyes of people who should know, is not a great capital city. We'll talk with Alice Rivlin and Walter Smith of DC Appleseed about what it would take to achieve that goal. And the one element that has persevered in Washington through segregation and integration, through good times and bad, is our obsession with our local sports teams, high school, college, and pro. So let's continue to argue about who is the best, what, when, with the Washington Post's Len Shapiro. He's compiled lists after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President-elect Barack Obama has chosen Mary Shapiro to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. Shapiro, a longtime securities industry regulator, is being asked to take the reins at a time when the SEC is criticized as a major factor in Wall Street's near meltdown. Mr. Obama has also nominated Gary Gensler to head up the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and Daniel Tarullo to fill an empty Federal Reserve seat. The White House says it is close to determining how to best rescue domestic automakers who may run out of cash in a matter of weeks. Spokeswoman Dana Perino told reporters today that President Bush wants to avoid a disorderly collapse that could result in job losses across the auto industry. The White House agreed to step in after General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford failed to win Senate approval of a $14 billion measure. A mayor of one of the cities where Chrysler is shutting down for a month says he is concerned that the temporary closing could be a sign of things to come. Chuck Kernbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Chrysler operates an engine plant in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that employs 850 people. The plant usually closes for about 3 weeks during the Christmas holiday. So Kenosha Mayor Keith Bosman says the local plant, being part of a nationwide month-long Chrysler shutdown, may not be all that tough on his community. But Bosman says it's the long term that worries him.
A bigger disaster would be the plant shutting down altogether. And that's certainly in play, given the economy, given the potential downsizing of the big three, Chrysler included.
Bosman continues to hope that the White House and Congress will complete a financial aid package for U.S. carmakers. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kernbach in Milwaukee.
Arizona is in the midst of a huge snowstorm. Nearly 2 feet of snow have fallen over the northern part of the state in the last 48 hours, with more on the way. Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris-Cole reports.
Schools and roads remain closed for a third day this week as Arizona continues to be hammered by a series of strong winter-like storms. More than 2 feet of snow has fallen across the state's mountain ranges. Flash flood watches and winter storm warnings remain in effect today for much of the state, with several more inches of snow in the forecast. Two hikers were rescued yesterday after being stranded in the mountains of northern Arizona for 3 days, and a major highway connecting Arizona to Las Vegas was shut down last night because of heavy snow and dangerous driving conditions. This marks the first time in nearly 30 years that Las Vegas has received significant snowfall. For NPR News, I'm Jillian Ferris-Cole in Flagstaff.
First-time applicants for unemployment came out in fewer numbers last week. The Labor Department reports new claims dropped more than expected to a seasonally adjusted 554,000. The Dow's down about 27 at 8797. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org.
This is WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Redlin. And with a look at those traffic lanes, Art Andrews.
And Bill, the word this hour is construction. Silver Spring, northbound New Hampshire Avenue between Quebec Street and Merrimack Drive. Emergency road work blocking the two right lanes. Going to be like that right through and up to the afternoon rush. The inner loop of the Beltway very slow, St. Barnabas Road to Alexandria, because of construction blocking the two left lanes, and an accident in Rockville, Veers Mill Road at Twin Brook Parkway. I'm Art Andrews on WAMU 88.5.
39 degrees in northwest Washington and WAMU 88.5 News. Conservative activist Paul Weyrich has died at the age of 66. Weyrich coined the phrase moral majority, and he helped to create the Heritage Foundation. At the time of his death, Weyrich was chairman and CEO of the Free Congress Foundation, another conservative think tank. Paul Weyrich was one of three founders of the Moral Majority, and later he had a hand in creating the Christian Coalition. MSNBC television host Mika Brzezinski was mugged in Washington just before sitting down for an interview with D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty. Rebecca Blatt has more.
Brzezinski co-hosts Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough. She was reportedly mugged outside a hotel while she was waiting for a car to pick her up before the 6 a.m. program. Scarborough blasted Washington as the show began. He claimed the unnamed hotel failed to provide security just outside its doors, as a man demanded $20 from Brzezinski. The TV host says she gave the man the $6 she had with her. Fenty was on the show to talk about education and plans for the inauguration. He said the incident would be investigated. Rebecca Blatt, WAMU, 88.5 News.
Education officials in Maryland are proposing a waiver process to allow certain high school seniors to graduate even if they fail standardized tests. The State Board of Education was to vote Wednesday on whether to adopt the waiver process, but the vote was delayed until today as they requested some minor changes. In the forecast, cloudy this afternoon, the high in the mid-40s, a chance of rain during the evening, more likely after midnight, the morning lows in the mid-30s. I'm Bill Rutland, WAMU 88.5 News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show. Later in the broadcast, a look into the soul of Washington, D.C., as seen by the city's sports fans. But first, we all know the district is a great city, but what would it take to make it a great capital city? The kind of place that appeals equally to tourists and residents, the kind of place where the traffic flows freely, the citizens are healthy, and the streets are clean and crime-free. Okay, we know we're not going to make the city perfect, nor would we probably want to, but with a new guy about to move in at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, a group of local experts are trying to think big about what it would take to make Washington, D.C. a world-class capital city. The answer, in a word, money. But of course, there's a lot more to it. Joining me in the studio to talk about their proposal and a new report that looks at how Washington stacks up to other capital cities is Alice Rivlin, director of the Greater Washington Research Program at the Brookings Institution. Alice Rivlin was the first director of the Congressional Budget Office and served as chair of the District of Columbia Financial Management Assistance Authority, also known as the Control Board, from 1998 to 2001. Alice Rivlin, welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us is Walter Smith, Executive Director of DC Appleseed. Walter Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We could define a great capital city in a lot of different ways, but what are the ways that you think we should be defining it as we move forward? First you, Alice Rivlin.
Well, first we tried to say, what is a great city? And we had a long list of things, good transportation, good schools, a sense of identity, and an attractive city with parks and things that people want, and a sense of itself. We had a longer list than that. But then we looked at what is a great capital city, mm-hmm. and that's a place that people want to visit, want to live in, and that the rest of the country is really proud of. That was our basic working definition.
Care to add anything to that, Walter?
Probably not. Alice usually gets it all quite correct. The important thing that I would add is that all of these areas that Alice has mentioned, and as you mentioned, take money. And most of them take money that needs to be invested in the infrastructure of the city, and it's infrastructure money that the city doesn't have to spend. And that's a key point we're trying to make in this report.
We're going to talk about later about where that infrastructure money might be coming from. In your report, you seem to hint that the founding fathers doomed us from the very beginning because they created their federal enclave from such a small piece of land. How has the fact of our physical geography constrained the city's ambitions, Alice?
I have a little fantasy that I'm sitting with the founding fathers and they're deciding about this capital. It was farmland. It was there was nothing here. And one of them might have said, well, how big should we make it? How about 20 miles square? And somebody else says, oh, we'll never need that much land. Let's go to a 10-mile square. And unfortunately, the second guy wins. And they didn't even keep the whole 10-mile square. They gave the piece that was in Virginia back. So we have about 66 square miles. Now, if the first guy had won, this
mythical person, we'd have had 100 square miles.
We would have had a bigger District of Columbia, and it would have included many of the wealthier suburbs that are now across the river in Virginia, or in Montgomery County, and that would have made us a much more viable city.
The report later goes on to point out that if the Founding Fathers had chosen a 30-mile land area instead, we would conceivably have had enough of a tax base that we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now.
I think that's right. If it were bigger, we would have these wealthier suburbs. Our problem is that it's a very small central city. Like many other central cities, it has a large poverty population as well as wealthy areas. But the middle-income and upper-income people who work in the city mostly don't live here. And we're not allowed to tax them. That's a special prohibition. So the district has a particularly difficult revenue situation.
Essentially, this report, Walter, calls for the federal government to make the district a higher priority, which in essence all comes down, I guess, to money. How much money are we talking about, and through what channels would this money flow to us?
Well, it could happen in lots of ways, but as you know, the federal government is poised to spend quite a lot of money on infrastructure. And what this report says is, beyond the very important rationale for creating jobs in a declining economy in this region, there are other really compelling reasons in addition why the nation's capital should be on the federal government's short list as it begins to spend money on infrastructure.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you have questions or comments about how Washington, D.C. can in fact become a great capital city. 800-433-8850. You can send your email to kojo@wamu.org. Alice Rivlin, this is an interesting moment to be making this case because on the one hand, we're in seriously grim economic times. On the other hand, President-elect Barack Obama is vowing to pour a lot of money into infrastructure. Can you talk a little bit about the politics that we are living in right now and the timing and release of this report?
We started on this report before we knew how bad the economic situation was going to be, although we did know that there would be a new president in to January of 2009. So we thought this was a moment to draw attention to the difficult situation of the district, its need for improving its infrastructure. And now, all of a sudden, we find that in response to the dire economic situation, the Obama administration coming in is talking about major infrastructure spending. So it seems to be a good moment to get this report out and in circulation.
Largely coincidental, Walter?
Well, it's somewhat coincidental. Alice Rivlin always has great foresight as to where things are going. We began with the notion there were compelling reasons why we ought to be in the business of building a great world-class city. And it happens that we knew when we had that vision, it was going to take infrastructure funds to create that. The other thing that I think needs to be added that's in this report is that's brand new that people may not realize. We have a chapter in which we compare our federal government's treatment of its capital with that of a number of other Western democracies. And we show that, in fact, our federal government treats our capital city pretty poorly on a number of fronts. We also show that if the federal government were to do nothing more than compensate the city for something that Alice Rivlin mentioned a minute ago, which is our inability to tax non-residents and our inability to tax the biggest business in town, which is the federal government. If they did nothing more than compensate us for those two things, this city could make major strides toward becoming a world-class city.
You know, there are two aspects of that that I'd like to discuss. Allow me to first start with the inability to tax people who come into the city to work. It's been generally called, Alice Rivlin, a commuter tax, but you feel that that, in a way, is a misnomer. Why?
I do. I call it a non-resident income tax. Every state has the power to tax the income earned within its borders by anybody, whether they live there or they don't live there. We are a unique jurisdiction in that we do not have that power. Congress took it away from us, although they gave us full state responsibilities. We have to do everything, we as a government, that states have to do on top of being a city and doing everything cities have to do.
So, and states do it. They don't call it a commuter tax, do they? It's a straight-up residential or non-residential income tax.
They call it an income tax, and it's paid by anyone who earns income in the state.
Allow me to go to the telephone since we're talking infrastructure. Here is Michael in Washington, D.C. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I appreciate it. I have some unfortunate opinions here, but for the group that's there, but I just don't think that D.C. has the infrastructure, the actual layout of the road systems to be a world-class capital. And I say that because you simply cannot access the city from outside without waiting in traffic for at least an hour, and I'm doing it today. I went to law school here years ago. I live north of Baltimore now. It took me about an hour to get from 20 miles north of Baltimore to the D.C. line, and it took me an hour to get from New York Avenue to Reservoir Road, and now I'm going up Wisconsin Avenue, and it's taking me about an hour to get to. I'm not even in Bethesda yet, so this is not conducive to coming into the city. I despise coming into the city. I only do so when I have to on business or on Sundays to go to the Smithsonian. There's so many great things in D.C. It's a great town otherwise, but unless there's some access to various points within the city through interstates, through rapid ingress into the city, it simply can't get any better than it is now, I don't think.
Well, we are, in fact, talking infrastructure, Alice Rivlin.
Thank you. You're singing our song. We really need to improve the transportation system, and that means much better mass transit and ways of getting some of those cars off the highways and improving the access to the city. I thoroughly agree and think this is a major problem for not just the city, but for the whole area. We've got to improve the transportation infrastructure.
Walter Smith, Mayor Fenty is currently putting together a proposal for the Obama administration, a kind of wish list that he's hoping will be funded through the president's stimulus package. What do you think are the most pressing needs that deserve additional funding, like right now?
Well, I think it tends to be the things that are in the report that we said are the indicia of a great city, and I've seen the preliminary list of things that Mayor Fenty is looking at, and it's all the obvious things you would think of. They have a lot of projects they call ready-to-go transportation project needs, roads and bridges. Everyone knows about the need to improve the 11th Street Bridge and the South Capitol Street Bridge Gateway. Money to improve school facilities, money to improve the water and sewer system. And these are all things where the district doesn't have the money it needs. It's ready to go to spend money on those needs. And they happen to be, and again, Alice Rivlin was prescient, they happen to be all the things that we need to build a world-class capital.
Allow me to go back to the telephones. Here's Charlotte in Alexandria, Virginia. Charlotte, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yeah, thank you. One of your guests in her earlier remarks had said something about if the original city limits had been 20 miles square, 30 miles square, some of the wealthier suburbs then would have been inside the city limits. And I was wondering how that would necessarily work if this was laid out in the 18th century. How do we know that those areas would have developed in the same way and in the same wealth and demographics as they have now.
Alice Rivlin?
Oh, we don't know that. I was being a little facetious, but if we could draw the boundaries wider, given the development that has taken place, I think we would be in much better shape. Most cities do have a core which has a low-income population and often a quite affluent population, and the middle-income people and many of the affluent people live outside, further out, and that's true of us. We're no different from any other place, so I assume we would have developed in a similar way.
We're going to take a short break right now. Charlotte, thank you very much for your call. You can still call us, 800-433-8850. We're talking about creating the world's greatest capital city. 800-433-8850. We're talking with Walter Smith of D.C. Appleseed and Alice Rivlin, director of the Greater Washington Research Program at the Brookings Institution. You can also shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. By the way, the name of the report we're talking about is Building the Best Capital City in the World, published by D.C. Appleseed and our nation's capital. You can find a link at our website, kojoshow.org. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Next time on Tell Me More, the latest in our series, A Global Memo to the President. We hear from the ambassador from Latin America's biggest and most populous nation, Brazil.
The fact that the United States was about to elect the first president with African ancestors, something that moved the Brazilian public very much and inspired us.
I'm Michelle Martin, Ambassador Antonio Patriota, on what his country hopes and expects from the next administration. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Yuck, they're greasy.
I know. They're not as good as my mom's.
A fourth grader fries his own latkes and cooks up a small miracle, and a reunion of friends reconciles ancient cultures. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join me and Murray Horowitz for those stories and more on the 2008 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
December 23rd at 9 on WAMU 88.5.
Hi, I'm Dori Anisman, the phone manager for the Diane Rehm and Kojo Namdi shows. I want to wish all of you a glorious holiday season and a new year filled with peace, health, and happiness.
SoftScribe provides copies of WAMU 88.5's top five most popular transcripts. More information is at WAMU.org under Programs or call 1-800-871-7072.
Now let's return to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
We're talking about making Washington, D.C. the world's greatest capital city with Alice Rivlin, director of the Greater Washington Research Program at the Brookings Institution, and Walter Smith, executive director of D.C. Appleseed. Allow me to go directly to the phones. Here is Eric in Williamsburg, Virginia. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I wanted to talk about the idea that the original founders had, that the capital city should be able to sustain itself and not become just a political machine.
What would you like to talk about in that regard?
Just the idea of what everybody thinks about that. Should it be something that's isolated from the rest of the country, or should it be founded, or should the people who work there have some relation to the rest of the country and understand what they're going through and interact on their own?
I guess you're asking whether or not it should be an isolated federal enclave or whether it should be a vibrant city and maybe possibly a state. Alice Rivlin?
Well, I, of course, think it should be a vibrant city like London, like Paris, like I believe Washington is on the way to being. It is a much better city to live in and visit than it used to be, and I think it can be even better. Perhaps we should be a state, but that's another complicated subject.
And, of course, at the time when the city was created, we were a largely agricultural society, and it was, I guess, difficult to have the vision of what we would be today.
Absolutely.
On now, thank you for your call, Eric. On now to Jonathan in Hyattsville, Maryland. Jonathan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. You know, I've always I've lived in a lot of cities out west, and I've lived here since 2000. But I've always thought that the city itself should be like a laboratory in a way for everything that we want to do in this country. And you know, that includes a lot of things. But I always kind of specifically thought about why it's not more green. Why aren't, you know, every government building and every office, why don't they have solar panels or living roofs or, you know, water catchment systems and the chance to use this, you know, as a proving ground that can then be an example to, you know, other cities, the country, and even the rest of the world.
Walter Smith, that question itself, for me, is an indication of how far we've come.
It is. It is. And it's a very timely question because you asked me a minute ago about what's on the mayor's list. Part of what's on the mayor's list is the need to upgrade a number of district government buildings and to make sure that they are upgraded with efficient energy design and construction to make them as green as possible. That is something certainly that the mayor and the district government are committed to, and it costs money to become a model, as this caller is suggesting, for the rest of the country.
This report looks at how the funding and support for Washington, D.C. compares with the support that capital cities in other nations receive. How do we compare?
We compare pretty badly. And I think that the Congress actually is aware of that. One of the things the report points out is that 10 years ago, when the Congress passed the Revitalization Act to help the city when it was in near bankruptcy, in that very statute, Congress recognizes the revenue limitations that it puts on the city, the inability to tax non-residents, the height limitations, the inability to tax property in town. And at that time, Congress said, once the city gets its own act together and shows it knows how to handle things, we want to revisit the issue about what the next step should be. And this report says now is the time for that next step.
Alice Rivlin?
The irony is that Revitalization Act of 1997, though it did help the district, took away the district's continuing payment from the federal government. Unlike these other capital cities, we do not get a regular payment from the federal government.
As you both know, the issue of home rule is a very sensitive one here in the District of Columbia. Do you think the federal government might just seek more control of the district's affairs in exchange for a better funding structure?
I don't think so. I think we're beyond that. There was a time when the federal government, the Congress in particular, ran the city like a colony. But I think we have proved that we can govern ourselves. We can elect a good council and a good mayor and run our situation pretty well. I don't think the Congress really wants to be the city council of the District of Columbia.
Here's Alex in Washington, D.C. Alex, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I have a consulting engineering firm. We're a Maryland corporation, but we started in D.C. Our address is D.C. Our employees are in D.C., and we pay this franchise D.C. tax every year, and it's a substantial amount of money. And you made a comment that commuters don't pay taxes, but companies who work in D.C., they pay this tax because, as you know, the S Corporation, the taxes is passed through to the owners. But in D.C., you have to pay the tax from the top and then the pass through in the Maryland, Virginia, wherever you live. So I just thought if you can make a comment on that.
Walter?
Yeah, he's right. In many ways, the District of Columbia has very high taxes. But one of the reasons why it has very high taxes is it has to make up its revenue somewhere else since it cannot tax the 70% of the people who work here but don't live here. And you don't have to take my word for that. The GAO in a report in 2003 made that very point. We've got this built-in structural deficit. We've got high taxes. We don't have room to increase the taxes anymore, but we've got to find revenue for infrastructure somewhere else.
Thank you very much for your call, Alex. Here is Isabel in Washington, D.C. Isabel, your turn.
Yes, hello. I, too, am calling about high taxes.
I don't work in D.C., but I live in D.C. I work in another city, and I have to pay taxes in the city that I work in. I also have to pay taxes in D.C. because I happen to live here, and I pay the highest taxes in D.C. than I've ever paid in any state in my life. I pay higher, more taxes in D.C. than I do to the federal government. It's incredible how many taxes I pay. And what I see is that it goes for very little. They don't take care of the landscape. They don't take care of the trees in Washington. It's a very sloppy situation from what I can see. And I guess that what bothers me the most is that, you know, in Washington, you can't say anything about it. It's taboo, but it is an extremely high taxing place. And I think that one of the real problems is that so many people who work for the tax, the revenue service of Washington turned out to be stealing our taxes.
Well, you've made a number of very broad statements that are, frankly, Isabel, absolutely incorrect. There are not a great many of people who have been stealing. There has been a highly publicized incident in the Office of Tax and Revenue in the District of Columbia, in which people have been charged, convicted, and are going to jail. But to paint the entire city with the brush of those individuals, I think is frankly a gross exaggeration. But allow me to have Alice Rivlin respond.
Well, I agree with that, though any scandal of that sort is extraordinarily bad and embarrassing, and we all want to make sure that the perpetrators are punished and it doesn't happen again. In general, D.C. taxes are in line with what you would pay if you lived in Montgomery County, counting all the Maryland and Montgomery County taxes. And they're a little higher than what you would pay if you lived in suburban Virginia, because Virginia is a low-tax state, but it's a low-service state as well.
Isabel, thank you very much for your call. We move on to Joyce in Washington, D.C. Joyce, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. When I was young, you know, we used to walk from, say, around 15th and C Northeast to one of our favorite spots was the Medical Museum at GW or the Monument. And, of course, now, you know, you don't see many people walking. I walk all the time, anywhere from Eastern Market to the mall to Union Station, you know, as far as Columbia Heights. But I wanted to know if walking is figured in any of your research, which, you know, if it isn't or if it is, I'd like to be one of your informants. And, you know, one of the things that really sort of disturbs me, and I grew up over here on the Hill, where I still live, over by Carver Terrace, and our parks are pretty much monopolized with people with their dogs. And perhaps if you're out in the day, you may see a small cluster of women and sometimes a few men with little toddlers playing in the gym area.
Well, you know, making the city a more walkable city is one of the ambitions of the Fenty administration and one of the ambitions of D.C. Appleseed also, Walter Smith.
It is, and it's one of the indicia of a world-class city. What she is talking about is one of the factors that the Brookings chapter in our report makes clear ought to be part of planning for a world-class city. But again, I'm going to beat the drum one more time. To have attractive parks and to have attractive walkable areas of the city takes investment in infrastructure.
Thank you very much for your call, Joyce. And finally, this email from Jim in Arnold, Maryland. My question is, how do we make the rest of the country care about Washington? It appears that the people who live outside D.C. are apathetic to voting rights for D.C. residents, despite the intellectual and basic fairness arguments in favor of it. Commuters from Maryland and Virginia don't want to pay the non-resident tax, so their representatives in Congress vote against it. With other states and cities grabbing for all the federal money they can get and with no voting clout on Capitol Hill, how can we make our case to the public that Washington needs to get its fair share? Alice Rivlin.
Good question, and one we've been asking ourselves. A part of the reason for this report is exactly to dramatize what is possible here. The organization that sponsored this report, along with D.C. Appleseed, is called Our Nation's Capital, and it is explicitly trying to solve this problem, to go around to the representatives from other parts of the country and plead the case of the District of Columbia and why it is important to have a great city here and what the capital contributes to the nation as a whole.
As we mentioned earlier, the report is titled Building the Best Capital City in the World. It's published by D.C. Appleseed and the aforementioned Our Nation's Capital. Walter Smith is the executive director of D.C. Appleseed. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Alice Rivlin is director of the Greater Washington Research Program at the Brookings Institution. Good to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, who was the best what in everything in sports in Washington, D.C.? Leonard Shapiro of The Washington Post and Andy Polin. Join us. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, find out how we've all benefited from the life of H.M., a man whose extreme amnesia led to 5 decades of remarkable breakthroughs in memory and brain science. Today at 1 on The Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Next time on Tell Me More, the latest in our series, A Global Memo to the President. We hear from the ambassador from Latin America's biggest and most populous nation, Brazil.
The fact that the United States was about to elect the first president with African ancestors, something that moved the Brazilian public very much and inspired us.
I'm Michelle Martin, Ambassador Antonio Patriota, on what his country hopes and expects from the next administration. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
This afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. It's the BBC's World Have Your Say. This live, interactive program lets listeners participate in international conversations about current events. You can contact them for more information about getting your questions on the air at worldhaveyoursay.com. Click on Contact Us. That's World Have Your Say this afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. Complete schedule information for HD Channel 3 is at WAMU.org.
Today at 3 on Fresh Air, a new take on traditional Hanukkah songs. We'll talk with composer Aaron Baron Cohen about his new CD, Songs in the Key of Hanukkah, on Fresh Air coming up at 3. Now back to the Kojo Nandi Show.
It's the explanation for that funny burgundy and gold hat your bus driver wears every day in the fall, or the laughs you hear in the summer breaking out from the blacktop down the street, or the voices on the TV that rock you to bed every night at 11. Sports have a way of invisibly shaping our lives, even if you're the kind of person who does everything possible to avoid the sports page. And in a region where people are often split by income, by race, and by political party, ugly jerseys and corny fight songs are often the only things that can bring all those people together, which is why seats in the press box have given Leonard Shapiro and Andy Polin a window straight into D.C.'s soul. They are the co-authors of the book, The Great Book of Washington, D.C. Sports List. They join us in the studio. Leonard Shapiro is a sports columnist at The Washington Post. Good to see you, Len Shapiro.
Nice to see you, Kojo.
Also, Andy, with us is Andy Polin. He's the co-host of the local radio program, The Sports Reporters. Good to see you,
Good to
Andy.
See you.
For some people, being a real Washingtonian might mean knowing who Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers are. For others, it might mean being able to remember what it was like to shop at Woody's or at Heckinger's or when Tyson's Corner was still a cow pasture. Where do sports fit into that experience of being a local in the Washington area, Len?
Well, I think, you know, there are institutions. We have a list of places that are no longer here, places like Woody's and Raleigh's and Dark Drug and People's Drugs. And these are very familiar names. Sports fans who of a certain age remember them, and we just thought we'd have some fun with that.
Yeah. And indeed, this is a great deal of fun. You guys co-wrote a book back in 1999, did you not?
Len wrote a book. This is my first and maybe last experience writing a book, although I hope not. But this was a book that I was actually contacted about writing by a group called Running Press in Philadelphia. They'd had some success with a similar book called The Great Philadelphia Book of Sports Lists, and they wanted to kind of franchise the thing, and it's been done, I know, in Cleveland, Seattle, Chicago, a couple of other cities, and we're the Washington franchise.
Well, I've been in Washington for 39 years, and I got to tell you, this book will now become like my, dare I say, Bible, because I'll
we
be
hope
going,
so.
Well, thanks, Coach.
There's no place I go that this book won't be going.
And you know what
so
you can
do?
Tell your friends.
Yeah, and just like the Bible in the hotel room, just spread it around. Just put it in every hotel room in the city.
There's an idea that gets kicked around a lot that Washington is a transient place, a town that changes shape every time a new president moves into the White House. How do you respond when people say that?
Well, I'm a transient, but I've been here since 1969, yes, it is, but I think that's more of a thing of the past.
Yeah.
I think there are an awful lot of people who have born, raised, grew up here, and have been here for a long time.
Yeah,
it's not true.
Several generations of Poles.
Yeah, I would say, you know, in my experience, I'm 50 years old. I've spent most of my life here. I have a lot of friends whose parents also grew up here and stayed here. So I think, you know, that people who are in the government tend to know people who are transient, and they think that everybody in Washington is like that. But this is a big city with a lot of people, and it's all spread out, and I think there are a lot of us who have been here most of our lives.
Yeah, just get to know us. Which teams or annual sporting events would you say are part of the bedrock of our local culture, the part that's immune to political change, Len?
Oh, Redskins, you know, and then Redskins. you know, that's the number one franchise. I think back in before we got here, Kojo, it was the Senators, even though they were dreadful. You know, first in
well, they were here for the first year that I was here.
Yeah, well, me too.
Bailed.
Yeah,
in
fact, I actually covered Ted Williams, and every time he talked, I couldn't quote him because there were too many bleeps in my notebook. But the Redskins own the town, and I think the coverage reflects it. Andy, you know, handles the calls. I don't know what the percentage is, but I would suspect during the season it's well over 75% and maybe 90.
I think it fits in with this area. This is primarily a white-collar town, and people don't have the time to invest in nightly baseball and basketball, but 3 hours of Redskins once a week is a nice fit. You know, Sunday afternoon you watch the game, you spend the rest of the week talking about it.
You know, the Redskins are a big part of local history, as you pointed out, and the player who put the team on the map, so to speak, Sammy Baugh, died yesterday. You list him in your book as the second greatest athlete in the history of this area, second only to baseball great Walter Johnson.
Yeah, and truth be told, you know, we could have made it 1 and 1A. I mean, they could have been tied for first. They both had a huge impact on the area. Baugh came here in 1930. You know, when the team first came here, they dressed him up in cowboy boots, even though he wasn't a cowboy, and they said his feet were sore, and then was involved in some of the greatest games in the history of the team until he retired in 52, including the 73-0 game that is the worst defeat in Redskin history and maybe in NFL history. And somebody once asked him, you know, apparently early in the game they were had a chance to actually take the lead and Baugh overthrew a guy, and he said, well, how would the game have been different if you had completed that pass? He says, well, it would have been 73-6.
I think the big difference, too, between Walter Johnson and Sammy Baugh is Sammy Baugh won, and he won early.
Yeah.
Walter Johnson, they did have a championship team towards the end of his career, but for most of his time in Washington, the baseball team was lousy. Baugh won the first year he was here, and he won a few years later, and over most of his career, they were contenders, and I think that's why that helped to make this really a Redskin town.
Yeah. And Baugh helped to change the game significantly in terms of the forward pass, didn't
he? Oh, absolutely, yeah. Nobody threw the ball like that since until he arrived.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of guys, and the ball had changed, too. Early on, there was a guy named Benny Friedman, who was a great quarterback who, if he completed 45% of his passes, great, but he was throwing a ball that looked like a cantaloupe. By the time Baugh showed up, the ball was pretty much in its current
little bigger, but yeah.
A little bigger, yeah. But
much more like it is today, yeah.
Well, people in D.C. still talk about John Riggins, Art Monk, Daryl Green, but Sammy Baugh is the only player whose jersey number the team has ever retired.
Well, part of that may be that they didn't expect all these players to come along. You got to remember this. When Sammy Baugh played, the roster was 23 players.
Right.
Weren't that many guys. And as football has evolved, it's now 53 on a roster. So there have been many, many more. And the problem with retiring jerseys is you run out of numbers. Although many of the great players who have played here, like Charlie Taylor and Sonny Jurgensen and Larry Brown, their numbers have not been in use since they retired.
Traditionally, yeah.
This is true. We're talking with Leonard Shapiro and Andy Polin. Together, they are the co-authors of the book, The Great Book of Washington, D.C. Sports List, every list you can conceivably think of as you argue with your friends about who was the best or the best 10 anything in Washington, D.C. sports. People remember the Super Bowls and all the big wins and losses against the Cowboys, but the Redskins are also closely linked to D.C.'s racial history. What social significance does the team have for you?
Well, the Redskins were the last team in the National Football League to integrate, and George Preston Marshall, who owned the team, many people thought was a racist, and his rationale always was he had a radio network that stretched from Maryland all the way pretty much into Florida. And he did not. He always said he was the team of the South. There were no Atlanta Falcons. There were no New Orleans. There was no Miami. And he felt that if he put a black player on his team, they wouldn't listen in North Carolina and Richmond and maybe in South Carolina even too. So, finally he got Bobby Mitchell came here and made a trade for Ernie Davis and
Ernie Davis wouldn't play for him.
Yeah, and Shirley Povich, the longtime great sports editor of the Post, used to write when Bobby Mitchell or Jim Brown came to town and would score, that they integrated the Redskins end zone.
Yeah, but you know what the impetus for the integration was. And I believe we have it in the book. It was Mo Udall.
Senator. Yeah, who was the Secretary of Interior.
And he said to the Redskins, you're moving into a new stadium, which was then called DC Stadium. Federal land. We won't let you play in that stadium on federal land unless you integrate the team. Now, they did not have to take legal action on it. I guess just the threat of that caused them to do that?
Yes, yeah. Stuart Udall.
Stuart Udall was the senator. Okay, and that's what caused them to make the trade for Bobby Mitchell. And Bobby Mitchell, among other things, a great person, also a great player, so that really helped things.
Of course, when I came to town, there was Charlie Taylor, there were Brick Owens and a few others who came along as early as shortly after Bobby Mitchell did in town. But I guess for most African Americans, the relations with the Redskins was really sealed in 1988 when Doug Williams, quarterbacking the team, was able to win a Super Bowl. I can tell you, watching that game, when he got injured in the first quarter, the almost exclusively African-American group that I was sitting with just about all decided it was over, was done, it was never going
all
to
All Redskin
happen.
Fans felt that way. Because Jay Schrader came in and got sacked twice. So, we're very happy when Doug Williams came back
came
on the field.
Came hobbling back onto the field and was able to win that Super Bowl. 800-433-8850 is the number to call if you'd like to join this conversation with your own memories of sports in Washington, D.C., high school sports, college sports, or professional sports. 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. We talked about RFK Stadium, and one of the things you talked about in the book is the 10 things you loved the most about RFK Stadium, the 10 things you hated the most. But even before we go there, the comparison to National Stadium. How do you feel about National Stadium?
Well, I think it's very nice. I don't think the team has marketed it particularly well. Like, they scared people away in the beginning by saying there wouldn't be parking, get there early in Metro. And that's not true. I mean, it's fairly accessible. And not fairly, it's very accessible. Yeah. Of course, they don't always have sellouts. But, it's a terrific ballpark to watch a game. It's a terrific – the players love it. They hated RFK, obviously, where the ceilings dripped and you're lucky to get a hot shower.
but you guys loved RFK.
Well, I think the fans, especially for football, it was a great place to watch a football game. It was easy to get in and out of. And I think it really gave the Redskins a tremendous home field advantage, which they have not really enjoyed since they moved into what is now FedEx Field. It was Jack Kent Cooke Stadium when it opened. And you've seen the video, and if people who have been there before know this for the big games, the stadium would shake. Yeah. I mean, you'd see the stands bounce up and down. You won't see that at FedEx Field. Place is too big.
My first memory of that, I was covering the team in 1973 when Kenny Houston, the great
Safety.
Hall of Fame safety tackled Walt Garrison of the Cowboys at the goal line, and the press box shook. I mean, I thought there was an earthquake. And as reporters, we loved RFK, but we also hated it because it was an open press box, which was tough to type when in the middle of December in a playoff game. But it was a great place.
And in those days, you were typing on manual typewriters.
Absolutely. And the ink
strong fingers.
The ink would freeze. Yeah.
Former Georgetown basketball coach John Thompson provided you a list of the 10 best playgrounds to play basketball in the Washington area, and it's a list that dug into the darker corners of some Washington history. Talk about that.
I spoke to John Thompson about this list, and he mentioned, I think there are 11 playgrounds in there, some of which he used to play on, and some of which he used to scout talent when he was coaching at Georgetown. And he told me a story of being invited to play in some type of a tournament or all-star game at Chevy Chase Playground, and he was driven there by two men who were white, and they got out of the car, and they saw that John Thompson was black. And John Thompson was a great basketball player in high school. He played at John Carroll, one of the great teams of all time, and he also played at Providence and spent a couple of years with the Celtics. So it wasn't a question of his talent. The question was his skin color, and he was told that he couldn't play in that game, and the two men, he said, who brought him were unbelievably embarrassed that they had put him through something like that. And, something I'm sure he remembered as he blazed a trail much later on at Georgetown.
And now, of course, everybody thinks of John Thompson as the great Georgetown University basketball coach, but when Len Shapiro met him, a lot of people don't know, he was the coach at St. Anthony's High School.
Yes, he was. The first time I interviewed him, I went to his office at the school, which is over in Northeast, and his office was about the size of a closet, and shared it with a Pepsi machine. You couldn't shut him up. He just kept going and going. It's sort of like he's on the radio now. Then, of course, it became Hoya Paranoia, which happened right after Patrick Ewing. You couldn't get anything out of him, but he was fabulous, and I love the guy.
He brought Patrick Ewing to the Washington Post so Len could show him around the newsroom and school him on how to deal with the media. Yeah. As a result of that, Patrick never spoke to the media.
That's right. Yeah, but I had to pay for the 5 orange juices at the Madison Hotel, which sent me back about 3 weeks of pay.
And he had like 5 hamburgers,
oh,
too,
right?
Oh, my
goodness. It
Patrick,
was terrible.
Yeah.
For a long time, sports have connected people from Washington with Baltimore. If you wanted to catch a baseball game, you had to head north because the Orioles were the only game in town, which is one of the things I really resented because I had to raise my children in Washington with no baseball team here, and that's why they're not big baseball fans today. So anyway, how have sports shaped the relationship between these two cities?
Between Baltimore and Washington? Yeah, I mean, the thing you've just brought up is very interesting. There is a generation that grew up, maybe a couple generations, without baseball and were asked to adopt the Orioles. And when they built Camden Yards in 1992, Tony Kornheiser, I think, wrote a column saying that's it for baseball in Washington because it was so convenient for people to just drive up 95 and go to this beautiful stadium. And I think there was that feeling for a long time. Fortunately, we got a team here. That was, I think that was a one-way relationship, Washington with Baltimore. My in-laws, my wife is from Baltimore. The people there never adopted Washington teams.
Right.
And when the Colts left Baltimore in 1984, they put Redskin games on TV in Baltimore saying, well, this is your team. And they said, no, it isn't. Our team is the Colts. They left. We'll wait till we get another one.
That's true.
And there was not much of a rivalry. I mean, back in, when Johnny Unitas in the 50s and 60s, the Redskins were dreadful. And then the Colts would kill them.
Yeah.
The Orioles and the Senators, everybody killed the Senators. So there was not much of a rivalry between the two towns.
They're the co-authors of the great book of Washington, D.C. Sports List, Leonard Shapiro of the Washington Post and Andy Pollin, co-hosts of the radio program The Sports Reporters. They say the best reason to love Baltimore is Cal Ripken Jr. I might add Eddie Murray. Other reasons to love it include Camden Yards. What's the top reason to hate Baltimore?
Well, without going after a lawyer who's probably going to sue us, but I would say Peter Angelos is right up at the top of a lot of people's lists. I mean, he's done nothing with that franchise. It's gone all downhill except for the ballpark, and a lot of people think he was the guy who kept baseball from coming to Washington for many years. He is not particularly liked here,
right. And
I know he's hated in Baltimore.
Yeah,
and he's a lawyer, so Peter Angelos, that was Len Shapiro who
said
right.
Not me. And he goes after asbestos people.
Yeah.
Here is Jim in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo.
Hi,
thanks for taking my call. I got a question, trivia
sort of question and then a little memory of RFK. You guys remember who the last person to hit or tackle Walter Payton was?
Last person to tackle Walter Payton? That would have been that playoff game in 1988. I don't know, Monty Coleman? Is that a good guess?
I'm fairly certain I'm right. It was Darryl Green.
Okay.
He hit him for a good shot, too. That was like, it was like 15 degrees below zero or something like that without the wind chill factor.
It's a game where Darryl took back the punt and tore rib cartilage doing it, right?
Yeah, he tore his, yeah, and his rib and stuff. But my most memorable time at RFK was in the NFC Championship with the Minnesota Vikings when I think it was Darryl Green knocked that pass on that drive.
Darren Nelson.
It was Anthony Carter.
Darren Nelson.
Yeah.
Hey, Jim, the book is called The Great Book of Washington, D.C. Sports List.
And that's in there, both those things that he mentioned.
You sound like
book.
A candidate for it, Jim. Thank
I've been around a lot of demolition and construction and stuff like that, but I've never heard anything like that in all my life.
The noise.
When he knocked that pass out or stopped that drive and we won the championship. It was unbelievable.
Jim, thank you very much for your call. It's impossible to avoid some of the personalities who come up through the local sports scene, especially the ones who are on TV at 11 o'clock at night bringing you the highlights, or the ones who are on the radio every day arguing about the Skins or the Terps. I'm so glad you mentioned Glenn Brenner in this book.
Yeah.
Because Glenn Brenner, I mean, he just brought everybody to life in his sportscast. He could make you laugh no matter what he was talking about.
Yeah, a very unique talent, and also worked with arguably the best local news team at the time with Maureen Bunyan and Gordon Peterson. And he captured the town, and sadly, totally out of the blue, came down with this horrendous running a marathon, and the town. There are people who still come up to me and say, "God, it just hasn't been the same without him."
And it helped the rivalry at one time. George Michael and Glenn Brenner were kind of like Frazier and Ali. Each lifted the other one up.
I'm the proud recipient of the 1993 Glenn Brenner Emmy Award, but you're a radio guy, Ken Beatrice.
Y'all next. He started this business. I mean, Washington had sports talk shows before he got here. Shelby Whitfield used to do one. Right. Warner Wolf had done one. But he really made it an institution, and he had you believe, and he had all the answers.
And what he taught me was how to deal with callers.
Yeah.
He dealt with callers very politely and very allowed you to have your say.
Right.
And he would respond. Yeah. Thanks, Ken. Local people like Tony Kornheiser, Michael Wilbon, James Brown have all gone nationwide. Do we lose the local claim that we have on these people when they get that big on the national level?
Well, no. Well, Tony obviously stuck around and still does radio. Wilbon is appearing with George Michael, as is Tony occasionally. No, I don't think so. And JB has always considered Washington his home, and will do anything he can if he's asked to go on local shows. Yeah,
I think it's a source of pride that we've had this kind of success. And for a city that's not really a great sports town, to have all these great national sports people is, I think, a real feather in our cap.
Don't have much time left. What do you think Barack Obama should do if he wants to throw himself into the local sports culture when he moves into the White House?
Oh, the local. I thought you were going to mention the college football the playoff that he's pushing for.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
He's a White Sox fan, so I think he probably needs to pick a National League team. He can go up to Baltimore to see the White Sox, but the Nats play in the National League, so I think he needs to adopt the Nats as his official National League team.
And he also likes to play pickup basketball.
Yeah.
Georgetown.
No. 5 blocks away from the White House, he ought to go to the upscale Y at Rhode Island Avenue and get in that noon to 2 o'clock Lawyers League game, and he will get bounced around by a bunch of lawyers from K Street. It'll be a hell of a game.
Hey, Barack, remember you heard it here first from Leonard Shapiro, sports columnist of the Washington Post, and Andy Polin, co-host of The Sports Reporters on Radio. They are co-authors of the book, The Great Book of Washington, D.C. Sports List. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Enjoyed it.
Thanks, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.